But it is the least accurate of the three for a simple reason that the data is sketchy, the dating techniques leave a certain amount of uncertainty, and on two neighboring sites may not actually be connected sites and issues like that. So this is probably the least accurate. Currently, the most common is to do genetic study genetic mutations, and I will discuss a bit of that because the whole lecture was on that 2 days ago. So I will only briefly mention this. Besides, I am not a biologist. If you ask me too many questions on this, I will have more trouble than I have bargained for. The third method on which we will focus is this diffusion method on how you can extract a lot of pattern about the way people move all over the place over long periods of time. And that's where we have worked, and that's what I am going to focus on. Sorry? I can, but this is just the beginning of the story. So at some stage, for example, I will show you how genetic data supports what we do get by diffusion, and we hope that geneticists will look at our things and look at their data a little differently. And certainly archaeological sites and whole thing gets mixed, except that the story is still being written, so it is not completely done. But eventually, the three together will give you the story that you want. Okay. So first, about genetics, you get mitochondrial DNA from the cell of your mother, and because you get it from the cell of your mother, it goes from mother to children, and father doesn't contribute to mitochondrial DNA at all. So this mitochondrial DNA essentially goes from mother to children. At the other end, of course, are Y chromosomes, which go from father to son, and therefore they keep a track of paternal lineage. So this gives you maternal lineage, this gives you paternal lineage, and then the story is very simple. All that you do is you look at a certain number of genes, see some of them get dropped off, some new ones get added, and so on and so forth. And by estimating or by modeling the rate at which genes mutate or errors develop in copying genes, you can say who was connected to whom and since when they were connected and so on. And that is the procedure in practice, of course, getting data and getting the data clean and worrying about individual fluctuations, etc., is a big issue, and I'm not going to talk on that. But essentially, this is the basic idea of genetic technique as far as dating, as far as connecting people and migrations are concerned, and that gives you a picture something like this. So we now guess that about 100,000 years ago, we left from Africa. The red lines indicate maternal lineage, the blue lines indicate paternal lineage. They run more or less parallel, except for an occasional sharp line. But given the nature of data, one won't really worry about whether this line is different from this line and so on. And then you have spread all over the place. So you start about 1 million years ago from Africa. By about 70,000 years, you're talking about crossing Mesopotamia, Sumeria, or Iraq, Iran, and so on. And then you come into India. Eventually from India, you go down to Oceania. And right at the end of my talk, I will talk about going from Oceania down to South America. And then the more favorite group of geneticists is to say that our ancestors during the last ice age went across from Alaska. And essentially what happens is human groups come out of Africa, they come and meet near present day Israel, and then divide themselves into various groups. And Ankara or Turkey is considered the Central Asian place from which the entire migration and separation of human beings occurred. So that's what genetics data tells you. In fact, it tells you something more. What you have is maternal lineage over here, paternal lineage over here. We begin as human beings about 140,000 years ago, about 60, 70,000 years ago, give or take 10,000 years. People start moving out, and six different groups seem to have come into Asia. Starting from the original three, they split into six. And this lineage, for example, is will connect it to other stories. Some of them then went on to migrate to Europe and eventually to Americas. Some of them have remained in Asia. And one can, in principle, look at each of these lineages and see how they change. Similarly, as far as paternal lineage is concerned, three major groups of men, they divide themselves again into seven different groups into India, and they eventually fill up the rest of the world. So that is a story that you get from genetic studies in general, but there are some interesting questions that need to be answered. For example, if you take AF as African, EU as Europeans, AS as Asia, and NG as New Guinea, as the easternmost part of the world, if you wish, then the question is, did Africans come and remain Africans and just one single branch come out, went on to become Europeans, they moved a little further and went into Asia and went into New Guinea, or did they come out, African strain remained as it is, and whether it is the same group that came out from Africa, became Europeans and Asians and New Guineans if you wish, or did New Guinea people separately go from Africa to the rest of the world, and whether Europeans and Asians divided from Africa. So you can ask questions like these, and the answer, it seems, most likely is this story, that one group that remained in Africa continued to remain so. The group that came out from Africa essentially got divided initially into two, and then the top two eventually got divided into Europe and Asia. But there are interesting parts of this story which I am going to just leave with you without commenting on it, simply because it's an amusing to think about. And that is, if you go back to this map, there is something more to this map. Over here, humans mated with Neanderthals. So yesterday, there was this story about 4% of the genes coming from Neanderthals and so on. So we have Neanderthals and humans mixing over here. We have Denisovans and humans mixing over here. There is also a suspicion that Peking man and humans mated over here. There is also another species of early homos called Homo florentiens, who probably mated with Southeast Asian. We now have evidence, thanks to work of Shanti Bapu and others, that there was another tribe of early homos dated to about 1.8 million years who could have contributed to Indian genes, except that we haven't seen their skeleton. We have only seen the tools made by them and the environment in which they lived in South India, but we don't really have their skeletons or their genetic data to be able to see if they were actually mixes in India also. But you essentially have, so human race, even though Homo sapiens sapiens race remains the same and can interbreed, they have various components of genes of earlier Homo series, depending on which part of the world you talk about. Then, sorry, yes.
So, is there a Y chromosome from Neanderthal or mitochondrial DNA from Neanderthal?
The genes that we get from Neanderthals are essentially mixed in the entire sequence. So, you get it in both parts. They are not specifically to. Yes, yes, but okay, yeah, my obvious answer is that I really don't know all that many details, okay, but they should, I have never heard of gender specific traces of humans. We generally make a broad statement about human beings being what, 4% Neanderthals, okay. Then studying, simulating the movement of people is what we do, so let me talk about that. The purpose is that movements of people can be driven by geography, environment, population pressures, etc. And this simulation can be done, as I'll show you, I'll try and convince you, can be done with fair amount of accuracy. And such simulations, I will try and convince you, can reveal several interesting features of preferences of people and movement and location of different groups. Okay? The physics of it is straightforward. You essentially have to solve the diffusion equation. You take the spatial and time varying population changes, and then you fit in various constants of parameters like land mass that can sustain population, tendency to spread and population increase and so on, and in principle you can solve this, except that in reality you can't, because the habitability of land or the amount of population that a land piece can sustain is highly variable over the land mass of India. So you can't analytically solve this equation unless you make simplifying assumptions about how the geography changes, but you don't need to do that. Given the difficulty of changing G, it's easier to simulate the situation and see what reality looks like, and simulation doesn't turn out to be particularly complex. The basic idea is straightforward. You go to NASA and download a high precision map or high accuracy map of the world, which has four different data. So there is 1 kilometer accuracy, 2 kilometer accuracy, 4 kilometer accuracy, and 8 kilometer accuracy data, which you can download, and that gives you, divides essentially the whole earth onto grids, and for every 1 square kilometer or 2 or 4 or 8 square kilometers, you can get the geographical data about altitude and so on, essentially altitude from this data. They also have a 300 meter data, but that is computationally so intensive that we haven't really looked at it. On the other end, there is also, NASA also provides hydroshed data, which gives you water body availability across the globe. it has an issue in the sense that essentially if a given location is below sea level or local sea level, it assumes that it has water, but otherwise it gives you a pretty good idea about all the rivers and lakes of reasonable sizes across the globe. So, all that you do is to mix these two data sets, and then you have a complete geography about what the surface of Earth looks like with great precision, and then you just have to use your diffusion equation. To dynamically solve this diffusion equation, we essentially define four parameters about why a human being would go to a particular place or not. People like water, obviously, so they would conglomerate close to places of water. The closer they are to water, the better it is, but at least within reasonable space, we assume that they can live with water, because if there is a big river, you would essentially have subterranean water and so on. So, you can extract water to a reasonable distance from a given good water source. We assume flatness of land. We assume that people like to live on flat land and they don't like to live on high altitudes because it is close. So, we assume that it is on flatness of land. I'll give you the exact functional dependence that we use in a minute. We also assume that people don't like to live on very high places because they tend to be cold. So, we assume that people like to live below sea level, at lower ground level. So, we assume that all land masses above 5,000 meters are not inhabited. Nobody goes and lives at a 5,000 meter height simply because it is very cold. And in our simulation currently, we take water as a barrier. You can't cross the water barrier. So, if there is a large water body, that sticks up your population. So, we can't look at, for example, islands, and I will show you how that limits our study at the end of the talk. Based on we are assuming, it's not a particularly bad assumption, and I'll try and justify my assumption. Partly I'm forced to take modern data because that is what I have. But if you look at about 15-20,000 years ago, and I'll show you that data, the sea level was good 120 meters below. So the connectivities are slightly better at that time than they were right now. So for example, right now you can't imagine going to Andaman Nicobar. Well, there was a time when Andaman Nicobar and the mainland was so close that you could have jumped. And similarly going to South America. We haven't taken that. We are currently taking simply the land mass as available today. But on major continental size objects that we worry about, we don't. Okay? But if you want to really worry about shores, etc., then you need to worry about that. We currently don't use that data. It's a weak assumption if you're worrying about coast side. Yes?
5,000 meters not habitable.
Well, if it is more than, if you are taking 1 kilometer, if it's a more than 1 square kilometer of 5,000 meters, we assume it is not crossable. Yes.
How do you consider the Aboriginal population?
We don't go to Australia as of now. As of now, we don't go to Australia simply because we don't jump the water barriers. Okay. So, we don't even go to Sri Lanka, for example, in the simulation that I will show you. Based on this, we define absolute habitability. Given any piece of land, how much land mass it can sustain will depend on how much water it has, how flat the land is, and what is the altitude of the land. Essentially, on these three parameters only, we assume that the fertility of land essentially depends on water availability and so on. So, these are the relatively simple assumptions. We also define relative ability, because when you put in people, more people can't go in. No land mass will take infinite number of people. So, once we start populating the people, we define relative habitability to be able to calculate the immigration and emigration rate from any given piece of land. And then we put population wherever we want to and start our simulation. Just to clarify, we take a piece of land like this, divide it into small grids, and then define individual properties of each point on the grid, and then start the story. Just to give you the parametric fit for altitude, we assume that people initially would like to have as flat a land as possible, but they would be willing to live up to a few thousand meters land mass. By the time you come to 4,000 meters, they essentially give up on that being too tall. On the other hand, for water surface, the probability of staying close by falls very steeply, then there is a marginal flatness, and then it sinks. Surface flatness. For water availability, within 10 kilometers, everybody is very happy. If you go further away, then the probability keeps decreasing, and by the time you go to 25 or 30 kilometers, it dies out. All these are free parameters which in principle can be changed, but for all the simulation that we have used, we have kept these things constant.
Sorry, these are the functions you are assuming, is it?
This is the assumed function. This is entirely out, by hand. What we did was we looked at the population distribution as a function of height all over the world, and roughly it fits this kind of patterns.
So
on that basis we have taken this. Yes. Okay. Then it's yes. I am talking about very early time periods. I am not taking conflicts at all. Yes. So, we do not take technology, we are talking about 20,000-30,000 years ago at the latest, more like 100,000 years to 20,000 years. Okay. So, what we do is we take the square piece of each square piece, we know its altitude, flatness, proximity to water, etcetera, etcetera, we know what is the desirability, how much population it can hold, we check up how much population it already has, and then for each of these neighboring four, we do the same, and then we calculate a certain amount of emigration rate and immigration rate depending on how it is already filled or not filled or whatever it is, and the details of the parameters are sort of taken into account. Once you do that, you now have a model which runs. Now the question is that model valid or not. The easiest thing to do was to look at England because it's an isolated island and therefore it's easier to study. So we looked at England. And we put population as given from the prehistoric data, we put population in South England, Cornwall, Wales, North England and Scotland, and let the simulation run for itself, and I am going to let you see the simulation. So essentially you put people at various places and then let the simulation start. The larger population is put here simply because of the fact that it could easily come across from France, but there is evidence that there were people all over these places. And then the simulation runs. This is a 1 kilometer resolution data. So each step is about 1 kilometer. And there are other independent studies that suggest that people typically tend to move about 1 kilometer per year. And therefore, this roughly comes to the clock from the start to the present.
How did you choose the starting point?
Based on what archaeological data, ancient archaeological site data is available from England. If you look at, go back and look at prehistory of England, there is literature which says that there were people here, here and here. On the other hand, this is not particularly sensitive to, this is not particularly sensitive. If you change the location a few kilometers away, eventually the local habitability of the land will make sure that you get a population pattern fitting in. So it's not a particularly sensitive parameter, but we take it based on what is available in the literature, yes. Yes. Not only that, ancient prehistoric archaeological sites in England are mapped.
So, my question was, based on, so, you have to say 2,000 years ago, then you have something called the model then you have some periodic surveys.
Yes.
So, how does this compare with that model?
I'll come to how it compares with the other data. So, we have essentially 5 different examples just to give you about what happens, and then you can test whether this data is valid. Yes. Sorry? So, we initially put any population we want. The population increase rate is about 0.1%, and the amount of population that a given square can sustain depends on the geography of the place. Okay? So, you can take this map, for example, of finally we have in England, and our prediction says that there should be more population here, and so on, and you can compare it with modern data, and it doesn't do very badly. In the sense that most of the locations that you get are fairly close to what you get, what you would expect. More interestingly, you can take the genetic data of Europe, which is, sorry.
Is there a sense in which neglecting the population increase for a moment, the distribution parameters become stable because the time?
It does. Population eventually will become stationary here. I will show you where. That's an interesting question. The population becomes stationary here. This is the habitability map of your England, which is what we begin with. So, ultimately if you keep on running the simulation, this is the picture you will get, because this gives you detailed habitability of various places.
It actually agrees with
it, yeah. If it reaches, when it reaches equilibrium, it comes to this. Okay. So, you can do this. More importantly, you now have a detailed genetic map of England, which is one of the additional reasons why we chose England, and you can see that various groups meet at various locations on this map. which has been, like I said, independent study of some completely different group. And when we do our mapping, matching, we find that the groups where we expect different groups to move merges precisely where the genetic data also shows turnover of populations. So we are fairly confident that our simulation does not do badly. And like I said, it is not particularly sensitive to the exact location point. You could take it a few tens of kilometers here and there, and you really don't see a change in the result. So the obvious thing to do was to look at South Asia. Okay? And South Asia is an interesting place. You have some interesting genetic data. What I have here is in these squares is the data from Indian tribes for a particular genetic mutation. And in the main map, you have the general population. So genes that are typically seen in tribes, for example, in Kerala and in northern India, is one of the most prevalent genetic variant that you see in India. There are some, for example, that are seen in mainland India all over the place, but if you look at tribal India, it's only seen in Kerala. There are others which are very prominent in Kerala, which essentially along the west coast completely, starting with South India to Maharashtra and Gujarat. But in mainland population, it is seen a little over here, and surprisingly, it's seen a bit over here. There is this particular mutation, for example, which is very prevalent among the tribals of India, but in the general population of India, you don't see any of that variation at all. You essentially see it in Southeast Asia, and so on and so forth. And there is one mutation here, for example, which is seen in tribal North India, is now seen at various places. Then there is also this great question about the Austroasians of India. There are several distributed tribes over here which seem to have a direct connectivity to Southeast Asia. These genes are missing from the mainstream population of India, but can be seen only in tribes of India, and these are called Austroasian tribes of India, and they have a connectivity more to Southeast Asia. So if you look at India, you essentially have three entry points into India from the west. The first is along the sea, where you can go along the sea and climb up and go out. The other one is along the Bolan Pass, which brings you to the Indus Plains. And the third one is along the Khyber Pass, which takes you from Kabul Khyber Pass down to Himalayan mountain ranges and takes you over here. And these migratory routes were apparently followed in the sequence of the first one was this, the second one was this, and the third one was this, somewhere between 70 and 30,000 years ago. So if you look at the population of India as it was 30,000 years ago, you would have found ancestral North Indians over here, ancestral South Indians over here, ancestral Austroasians over here, and what is called ancestral, I have called Tibeto-Burmans over here. This population shares its genetic signals with the Tibetans. Austroasians share their genetic signals with Southeast Asians. Ancestral South Indians have a unique identity of their own, and ancestral North Indian tend to be share their genes with all the way up to Europe and so on. But what happens is, what surprised us, was that when you look at the geography of India, we talk about the Himalayan ranges and we talk about the Hindu Kush mountain ranges and the Western Ghats and Eastern Ghats, but we don't really look at Vindhyachal and Saputara mountains as something very serious in terms of geography. But if you remember your history lessons, you would realize that most of the kingdoms of North India prefer to spread east-west rather than cross the Vindhyas. There are very few kings of the historic period or prehistoric period who cross the Vindhyas, and similarly the kings of south of the Vindhyas never really bothered to go north, and that is because these mountains are far more forbidding than you and I would normally imagine. In the modern days of railways and aircrafts, of course, they mean nothing, but at that time they did. So if you look at what is a habitable map of India, if you had zero people on the earth, and if you asked for each point on earth which is the most livable space, you will see that this is a forbidding region. Tibet of course is completely gone, the Hindu Kush mountains are over here, and you have the central India over here. And because of the very characteristic of hydroshed, the run of Kutch actually is shown to be habitable because it is fairly reasonably below sea level. So if there was good rain over here, this would have been a very nice freshwater lake. It would have probably been the biggest freshwater lake of India. Today, of course, the monsoon rains don't reach here, so it's deserted. But you can see the Indus Plains, you can see the Gangetic Plains, and you can see various rivers over here and this modern point. So you obviously run your animation over here. We took 3 points of Hyderabad, Bhubaneswar, and Kabul and saw how the simulation works. And this is how the simulation works. And what you see is that the Austroasians and the ancestral South Indians mix over here, while the ancestral North Indians take some time and will eventually merge somewhere over here along the Narmada Plains. So, along Narmada Plains, you would expect to find a mix of Indo-Europeans and ancestral South Indians, and in the eastern side, you would expect to find Austroasians. So, this is what the map looks like, and you can go back and look at that map again. So, we looked at the data which is available again in the literature for about 8 tribes found in Central Asia, Central India, and we looked at their genetic makeup, partly from the results of the speaker who came day before yesterday. And you can't see this graph, but you have a table of complete data, and the graph looks like this. What you have here on the x-axis is the longitude, 75 degree longitude all the way to 85 degrees longitude, and the eight tribes that you find, their respective fraction of ancestral North Indian genes, ancestral South Indian genes, and ancestral Austroasian genes. You can see that as you go further east, the population becomes more and more Austroasiatic, while if you are in the center or in the east or western region, they essentially tend to be a mix of ancestral North Indians and ancestral South Indian. So, that is interesting. But what happens is that the program really doesn't take into account multiple waves of people coming in, but you can simulate that with a slightly different use of the game, which is that you start saying that, look, assume that the population distribution initially is very flat and don't bother to put in any high population over here. How would they coalesce? And over a period of time, they show you a certain coalescence pattern as they move towards regions of high water background. You can then take this map and put artificially extra people, and you will see that the coalescence rates changes. And therefore, in principle, if you go back and look at the archaeological sites, etc., you would be able to figure out how to compare population mixes and so on. The other issues that come up are that the simulations actually have no, except the fact that movement, there is really no specific property of human beings that we use. Okay? Apart from human beings, of course, people move, ideas move, cultures move, language moves, vegetation moves with people and so on. And therefore, the simulation itself is quite capable of simulating any of these things. So, while the problem with ideas, cultures and languages is that they mutate so quickly that it is not so easy to simulate it on a program like this. On the other hand, plants carried by people are easy to study. So, you can use the same simulation for plant studies. And what you have here is a map of ancient India. About 6,000 years ago, farming is supposed to have entered India, and then it spread about 4,500 years and so on into various patterns. So, you have 6,000 years here, 6,000 years here. This probably came from China 8,000 years ago, rice comes here, and you can get this kind of patterns based on archaeological data. But you can also simulate the same thing, and I'm not going to show the entire movie because I have something else to show. You can put millet over here, rice over here, and see how they will merge, and you can see that even as they move south, essentially this Indus and Gangetic plate connection means that these things move much faster in the horizontal direction than in the vertical direction. And you can go back and look at more detailed maps of where you find at farming at which period and so on, and this has been studied purely from archaeobotany, this data has been got, and when you put your simulation on top of it, it doesn't seem to do badly as far as spread of vegetation, plants or edible plants and their movement with people concerns. Even more in detail, if you look at, for example, the Gangetic plain, we know that rice essentially was first cultivated in Bengal and then spread to the rest of the country. And there are sites here, incidentally, the open circle sites are sites which have no rice, and the full circle sites which are sites with full with rice and so on, and at different periods. And I don't have time to do a detailed comparison, but our simulation doesn't do badly in terms of being able to say how the movements would have occurred.
Can one do analysis of animal genetics?
Yes, it can be done, yes. We haven't done it because, well, we should be doing it, yes. But it is, yes, because animals are also carried by people. So, in principle, animal genetics, actually you don't even have to do genetics, just the movement of animals. For example, horses come from Central Asia 3000 BC. So what we were interested in is, because Istanbul, or rather Turkey, is considered a place from where all the populations seem to have moved. So, we wanted to know how that happens, and this is how according to us it happens. You start with Ankara, if you wish, is where we had put the location. In principle, of course, the people first went from here and then stayed there. But if you change location from here to here, the long term simulation really does not make a difference. But the interesting thing that we realize, which I do not think has been realized earlier, is that the Caspian Sea is so huge that it actually divides populations into two. And you will see in this case, of course, they enter Africa from here, but you will see how the populations go. And then the populations, because this is one step per year, you can actually see the relative speed with which they are moving. Here they are moving much faster than over here, and so on. For a long time we worried about there being a lot of population in central Saudi Arabia, because the common impression is that Saudi Arabia is dry. It turns out in fact that Riyadh sits right in the middle of that high population density region. But you can see this clear split which meets over here, and then Tibet will provide you with a second split where one population goes over here and the other population goes over there, and you can see their mix and merger rather neatly. You can see the Nile River over here, and you can see the Indus over here, and soon you will start seeing, you can see the Sumeria, Mesopotamia, the great civilizations of Iraq and Iran and so on, and you would see why they would remain isolated, because going anywhere from there would have been difficult. So, massive civilizations developed around Euphrates and Tigris, and then you can see the Gangetic Plain over here, and then along Brahmaputra they would eventually go, and you can see these groups mixing and merging. I forgot to point out over here, you can see that there is a small passageway through this which people enter over here, which would give you things like founder effects, where only a small group of people would populate a large area like this one, and then they would have a signature of their own, because very few people would start this, and you will get a unique localized identity of people over here. And eventually, as the simulation goes on, I might as well finish it, you will see that the populations meet all over the place. And which, that is, well, the map is taken from somewhere else and simulation is taken from somewhere else. So, there is a slight error in the displacement. Okay. The map is taken from MATLAB's memory data bank. So, a slight error. Okay, so, that is how essentially the simulation ends. So, you have this interesting gap over here and another eventually which gets filled up. So, if you look at the world map, you actually have original starting from Africa, one that goes around Cairo and so on, the other one jumps from Saudi Arabia by sea and comes up. There has been some speculation whether people managed to jump from Spain also, but there isn't much of genetic data suggesting people went across West Africa and so on. And then they move various downwards, you essentially call these Austroasians. Why did they miss out from India? Why did they move almost completely out of India? What is the archaeological evidence they have left back in India is something that one can talk about for hours, but there are some interesting monuments left behind. One could probably argue that maybe other groups coming down pushed them out, but we really don't know. But you see their genes in some tribes in India, and you see them in Andaman Nicobar are essentially Austroasians. So, these Austroasians completely move out. Then because of this split, you get this Indo-Europeans who essentially come down from Bolan Pass and go on to very quickly catch on to Gangetic Plains, then go on to catch Brahmaputra. And then there are a whole bunch of rivers in Myanmar or Burma and further on. So, they quickly spread out like that. The other group goes off from Caspian Sea and comes around over here. So, there is a northern Chinese group and there is a very distinctly different southern Chinese group. The Chinese government does not like to talk about it, but that is a different part of the story. They would not want to have this distinction. So, you have this merger plus locations where various groups seem to have merged. The like I said, in northern or central India, we have these mergers of ancestral South Indians, ancestral North Indians, Austroasians and Indo-Tibetans. But the interesting thing is that the last of the great population migration into India was about 30,000 years ago. So, the so-called Aryan invasion and Aryan movement into India is essentially genetically not borne out. The number of Indo-Europeans who must have come around 5,000 or 6,000 years ago were essentially in very large number, just as we do not have any signature of British coming into India, because the Britishers, even though they ruled India, weren't really, did not come in large numbers. The number of people who came, who brought their genes was much smaller. and probably the same is true even of that earlier period. So this is the kind of map one can derive, and then one can look at differences between populations and so on. But the last important point that I want to make is the question that was asked, whether I am taking, assuming the same landmass today as of 40,000 years ago, and actually that is not, well, that's a weak assumption depending on which part of the world you want to study. So if you are looking at the ancient landmass of Earth, about 18,000 years ago, the sea was as much as 120 meters below what it is today. So if you look at the ancient landmass, on the other hand, if you look at India and its surrounding area, it doesn't make too much of difference. But this entire landmass over here makes a lot of difference, because all this was one huge piece of land, and one could actually move around in these areas without having too much of water to worry about. So the entire Southeast Asia, the Sea of Japan, and all these regions were essentially one huge landmass, and one could even walk down to, or nearly walk down to, Andaman and Nicobars, because those areas were well connected, and we don't take that into account. But as long as we are staying with the major landmass of Austroasia, really the simulation doesn't have a problem about worrying about changing landmasses. The only interesting point I want to make, and which has again not been made, is that if you look at the sea levels 12,000 years ago, there is actually a very nice connectivity between Polynesian Islands, the Freedom Islands, I think. And then down the way, there is a line, and there would have been a whole series of islands through which people would have jumped and eventually reached South America. And there is some new genetic data coming in, which says that the humans did not go through this channel, but probably, or at least some of them went through this channel, and some of them went through this channel. Because as you can see, Japan and everything is filled essentially by a landmass, and this landmass would have allowed people to walk across. And the fact that northern latitudes have a lot of snow would have made this landmass even more easy to cross. So the bottom line is that studying migration of people provides a wealth of data about movement of early humans, even without too much of hassle. It can be done with a relatively simple set of assumptions and not a serious amount of computing power. The computing power you need is not all that serious. It also provides a far broader perspective of how the genetic data must have moved, how people must have gone across various regions, and it is well supported by whenever you get genetic data and you compare it, we don't run into any serious contradiction between what we predict and what they have. At the same time, it's a rather simplistic model. It doesn't take several things into consideration. So, for example, it does not include temperature gradient as you go across the globe. It, in that sense, it is not sensitive to the fact that northern latitudes tend to be colder, so fewer people would go. It does not include rainfall data. So, for example, runoff course turns out to be water rich, because we don't really take into account the way the rainfalls fall and the waters and the rivers would change and so on. It is, of course, season independent. It does not include conflicts. So when groups of people merge, we just take that as a common total added population and not worry about them fighting with each other, or population changes induced by conflicts and so on. We also do not include change in sea level during the ice age. And like I said, depending on which part of the problem you are studying, this can be a serious issue or not a serious issue. Each movement is independent, so there is no past memory. There are other models in the literature which are agent-based model, where they actually remember their past histories and remember where not to go and where it was difficult and so on. Those are then become super. You still require supercomputers to run these things, because there are multiple agents and multiple programs. So we really don't do that. We assume that people really don't have any memories of the past. And it does not include inventions of technology. So when horses come, we really don't make a quantitative change in their movement. But because we are restricted to 20,000-30,000 years ago, you would not even get wheel by then. So if you were to extend this to 20th century, a lot of things would change. But since we are looking at 30,000 years ago, where even horses had not entered human civilization, wheel was not known. So this gives a fairly good idea about what early humans must have done and how they must have moved on. And despite all these simplicities, I think we have something that is interesting to look at. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes. the new information we get? Well, what happens is this.
You said new insights.
Yes. So, for example, this kind of map, this the movie that I showed you about the movement of people has never been created. The reason why that movie is interesting is because it gives you things like, I mean, very clear distinction between where different groups meet. Those kind of detail may not been available. Also, the other systems that you have will not give you such a large canvas imagery. Such a large canvas movement, it does not give. So, in that sense, this is unique because it gives you the entire canvas of movement. And what people have done is to look at local villages, how the local villages grew and local villages died and what would happen to. There was this game of, some 20 years ago, there was a very nice program, a game program where, I've forgotten its name, where you could do local wars and create local villages and stuff like that. If you want to look at the broad sequence of events, there is nothing like this. Yes. Yes. The final equilibrium that, as long as you don't change the land mass, as long as you don't change what data NASA has given you, it will reach the same equilibrium. In the sense that if you add an earthquake and change the river, for example, the way this, there was a river that once flowed, Yamuna apparently once flowed along what is present day Rajasthan and stuff like that, and there's this big controversy about Saraswati and stuff like that. If you don't do that, and if you keep the data as given by NASA, then the equilibrium is the same. Starting population you can change. If I change the population, it might be slower. And if I have multiple points, then I can check a conflict about whether the population will come from here much quickly or other very quickly. Those local parameters will change. No, the biologist in our group is missing, so I can't answer that question. But I think the England map that we have used, or even the tribal map that we have used, presumably uses that kind of data. But it's not something I am an authority on. Yes, sir. Correct. Yes. I have another simulation I can trivially show where you start with Cairo and eventually jump and fill up over here and then start distribution. Then essentially the later part of the simulation will not change. But there is a lot of, I took Ankara simply from archaeological data. And archaeological data is a lot of data which says that the first human urbanization and populations happened in Central Asia. And they identify regions near Ankara as Central Asian region where the populations happened. So I took Ankara as a convenience for archaeologists.
The important thing is the precursor of that civilization was from Africa.
That is true. And if I change to Africa. No.
Yes.
The problem is that we really have no idea where the ancestral Dravidians get their variation in genetics. Okay. If you look at all genetics papers, they suddenly put them there without really being able to figure out where they are. And that's why we are trying to contact geneticists. We suspect that this ancestral South Indians are a mix of Austroasians and the early hominin population that must have lived there. But it's not something I want to stick my neck out on simply because I don't have the data. But that's a question we have been floating as to why ancestral South Indians don't have relatives anywhere else. But they don't seem to have relatives.
Exactly, because your approach is different from a genetic one. You may be able to throw light on this.
Well, our suspicion is only this much. I mean, the reason why I made the statement that I made simply because of the fact that we know, because we know that if you look at European genes, they have a large fraction of Neanderthals genes, and Neanderthals are not Homo sapiens sapiens. So, similarly, there is some genes from Denisovans, and yesterday there was a proportional discussion, etc. There is also Beijing men, there is also a Florensian, and then there is evidence of an ancestral early homos in South India, 1.8 million. But the problem is that we don't have their genes. We only have the tools that they used. We have still not seen the skeleton. Once we see the skeletons and get genetic map, we probably may be able to see where the ancient Dravidians come from. Well, we haven't looked at, yes, so what happens essentially, I can do per kilometer movement, per step, etc., and measuring. I haven't done that. But I mean, visually you can see, for example, that when they start going through, Sumeria and all the leave Iraq, crossing Iran is not so easy. They find it real, they really struggle, and the simulation, the number of movement per step becomes quite low. No, Tibet is completely isolated. So, yeah, I'll show you. That is Nepal. Tibet is completely isolated. Yeah, Tibet is blank. In fact, Tibet and Caspian Sea turn out to be two major dividers of population. So, when you say six different people population groups exist in Asia, it is thanks to Caspian Sea, because then these two people meet much later when they eventually coalesce over here. Similarly, once Tibet divides them, they meet in South China much later, Central China much later. So, they are mutated enough to be considered different groups here. That is the assumption. I fully agree on that. So, if you go to central Maharashtra, for example, you get these tribes which are Austroasian and Indo-European living across the road, but they will not intermarry. Okay? If that did not happen, you won't get the signal. Okay? See, for example, there are these two tribes, for example, are not very far from each other by longitude and not even by physical separation, latitude or longitude. In many cases, they live across the street. But if you look at, for example, we have looked at their astronomies, the astronomies are completely different across the road. One group has certainly completely different, well, not completely different, but relatively different stories about the sky than the other two. Because populations tend to remain isolationist, you get this data still available. Otherwise, it would have been lost by now. Vertical axis is the ancestry. So, for example, in this particular group, 45% of genes are ancestral South Indian, 35% are ancestral North Indian, and only 5% are Austroasian. So, each of these on a vertical scale is one single tribe. Is one single tribe. So, it is all one single tribe. So, tribe number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Correct. Filled up. Yes. Well, for example, we were surprised that you can actually say that there are six genetic groups. We know exactly how those six differences came. I had not realized that Caspian Sea will actually divide populations into two. Tibet, you could have guessed. Similarly, I did not expect Vindhyas and Saputaras to keep these populations separated in a really difficult manner, and that they would meet only along the banks of Narmada. And when you go to Narmada, you can see across the bank different populations exist. So, in that sense, there are many surprises. And you can actually have, we don't have the genetic data, so we can't do that, but we can actually predict so-called founder effect. You see, founder effect means that a small group of people go to a particular place and then completely inhabited from there. So, typical example is Parsis, for example. Parsis have this big nose, it provides no genetic advantage. But the original founders have big nose, so they continue to have because they intermarry and so on. So, those kind of specialized properties you would see in certain population groups, which you can predict using the simulation. And then you need to go and map those genetic groups. Correct. Correct. Yes.
Then when they migrated from
Africa, correct, correct. Yes. Correct.
There are, I think, four distinct anthropological sectors there.
Yes. What happens is, there is selection effect definitely. Survival also depends on the selection effect. That is one issue. So, for example, you did not need dark skin if you were in European area because the sunlight is very weak there. So, you sort of got melatonin, I think it's called, in your skin. Even if it was less, you still managed to survive. While in Africa, if you were born with a color white skin, you'd essentially die of skin cancer very quickly. So some survival issues will be there. Also, some natural mutations and variations will be there, and so on. So those will give you the characteristic changes. And when people are separated over a long period of time, their signatures will be different. Yes. Yes. No, the advantage with Parsis is that they have intermarried and remained isolated.
Yeah.
Okay, so they have kept their genetic purity. But so within Parsis, you won't see as much variation as you. Yes, then there would have been more Parsis with flatter nose than we have today. Yes, it would have been lost. Typically, okay, I'll tell you this: an individual peculiar characteristic of genes that I have will be completely wiped out in 6 generations unless they are refed again and again. So, if Parsis had married into the local population there, by 7th or 8th generation, they would have all been flat-nosed.
Just want to ask, so what is the framework that you use for this simulation? Is it something completely designed by you? Or is
no, no, we say it sits on the MATLAB program.
Just MATLAB
program. The whole code sits on MATLAB.
Okay, what are the...
So, if you can't use MATLAB in the common frame, you have to blame for it because I block one copy. Yeah. Oh, elephant. Oh. Thank you. Thank you very much. See, that music was only for that animation.
Huh?
Animation.